Okay, so we're going to go into the Joyce Aquinas and the Poetic Process, written in 1950 or so. It's interesting reading Joyce. McLuhan's letters way back then. He's writing to his mother about writing this article. They're interesting how he presents it. We finished it last week, but the third part, I just read through it. I want to unpack it more and then maybe integrate the whole thing. So it begins with the S. Labyrinth and Thomas Aquinas' articles and how they're the labyrinth. And then he goes into the sensory process. Yes.
We had the link. We had the link, didn't we?
Yeah, you guys could look at it.
Okay.
I'll post it.
Thank you.
So, yeah, so maybe everybody can be looking at it. And point out anything I miss. So are you ready?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, so he's talking about Thomas Aquinas' articles, his writings can be regarded as vivisections of the mind in act. And he's going to break that down into stages of apprehension and the creative process, and the agent intellect is in there, or the nous poeticos. And then he talks about, for Joyce and Eliot, all art is a shadow of the incarnation, the manifesting of the Son of God, I guess. Then he flips into talking about cliches, profanities, and the vulgar. And then there's the three notes of the intellect, which reflect the three notes of beauty and the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. Then he gets into a little bit of Freud and Jung and anthropology. Then he gets into Portrait of the Artist as Young Man and Finnegan's Wake. And then he's going to get into Edgar Allan Poe and go back to the history of where what Mallarmé discovered, and then Joyce completed Mallarmé. But before Mallarmé, there was the Romantic poets around Thompson in the 1700s, James Thompson. And then that influenced Stendhal, Flaubert, and Dickens. And Edgar Allan Poe is in there in the mix. So then he then says the labyrinths are involved, the two kinds of labyrinths, stone and sea, and the act of epiphany, which is a moment not in time's covenant, and it is by the bringing of complex perceptions to a focus in such moments that the minotaurs of the labyrinths are always overcome. So he's talking about beauty involves not desire or appetite, but there's another level. In talking about Poe, James Joyce's character, Stephen Hero, talks about being a detective, that the Philosophic College should spare a detective for him that could help him. And he's also, McLuhan is saying, it's important to look at modern psychology, historiography, archaeology, physics, chemistry, and the private eye, how they employ the idea of the stages of apprehension or a retracing or a metanoia. Then he talks about the novelists x-raying the entire community in action. So then that would lead to media landscapes. He says that Stephen Hero, the book before the portrait was a rewriting of Stephen Hero, swarms with labyrinths of many kinds and levels. Then he goes into the two kinds of labyrinths and shows where they show up. One example is the phrase seawall. It's got water and stone. Then he wonders about the Pre-Raphaelites and Swinburne and Pater and Yeats, how much they were influenced by the symbolists. and what they didn't get, what Wordsworth didn't get. And then the labyrinth becomes a landscape. So that's moving into media dynamics. So he's going to make the labyrinth become the modern global theater. So he's giving the poetic antecedents, which relate to the stage of apprehension, and then you're going to get into the global theater with people going through collective states of apprehension, since their private brain power is pretty easily drowned by the global theater. So an interesting statement he says, on the labyrinth of the ear, which is the organ of the incarnation is capitalized, Joyce built those metaphysical analogies which enable him to restore the orchestra of the seven liberal arts to its plenary functions, or he turned the trivium and quadrivium into a more comprehensive purpose. McLuhan says he's never less than the artist of the word. Now, we know the Android meme makes the word be the market. So Joyce is intuiting that himself in his own Finding His Wake in Ulysses. Ulysses is reared on the labyrinth landscape of the human body as the body politic. And then Finding His Wake whispers throughout with the voice of the river of human blood and immemorial racial consciousness. Then McLuhan says Joyce was at home in all labyrinths because of his original conquest of the stages of apprehension of the mind in act. So we could say at that point, and I went further into what we did the other day. Part three, I'm well into it, just to get to this main point. So the central nervous system is the inside going outside, or it's the mind being externalized. It was a commonplace in the 60s for people to say, we're, the physical wars are over, it's now a battle for the mind of man. So the mind in act, and McLuhan breaks it down into various stages of apprehension of the sensory action in the body / mind, and then that becomes symbolized by different media characteristics in the collective extension of the mind in act. So sometimes McLuhan would call the mind in act the learning process, that we've extended the learning process, and everybody is forced to be engaged in it. Okay, so that's the trajectory. You go from, you know, the individual mind in act. Then he has some interesting mind-body merger, so that the mind is the action of the senses and the processes of awareness and cognition. So you don't have a mind-body split. And then the split between you and the world and media landscapes is dissolved. So that you're engaged in the stages of collective apprehension. And then we would add that the Android meme squares that process and actually doesn't mime the mind in act anymore, other than it shows clumps of humans and media dynamics having a battle, which is where McLuhan, he gets to that point where the landscapes are print versus movie, all these landscapes are having conflicts. So what does that make you guys want to say? Anything?
Well, for one thing, the learning, everything becomes the learning process or a learning process, and then that flips that or quadruples on itself, and it becomes, there's no learning in it. Is it? It be like,
yeah, you could say
education.
Yes, you could say that the medium is the massage isn't true anymore. The Android meme is massaging its parts, not the chemical body. So surplus flesh is left on the side. So when McLuhan was revived in 1993 as the masthead patron saint of Wired magazine, you know, he couldn't get more perfect than Wired, which was the digital Bible it became. So the digital Bible is celebrating the analog process, and it has nothing to do with McLuhan or any of us. It is the Android meme replaying the history of media for itself while attempting to make you very welcome in sharing it. But in the end, as people found in Web 1.0, they were shocked at going online and getting into a forum, how miserable the communication of a forum, quickly ended up, and that human civility just disappeared. That would be the main shocking insight that I noticed in Web 1.0. People had the naivety that they thought that people would be interested in being reasonable communicators. But what they didn't know is that humans had become severely alienated in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and were ready to fucking vomit on you when the opportunity came up.
Yeah, unaware participation. Participation without awareness.
Right, and partly intuiting that that communication between humans was dead. So this is absurd in 1995 to be able to pretend to talk to people. So let's get to the facts that there is no communication going to happen, no matching very quickly.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting that the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is that what they were called? John Barlow, the writer, lyricist for Grateful Dead, was a big guy in that scene. They would come out with slogans like information longs to be free. The incredible naivety of communication, which naivety would have been stiffened up and made more aware if they'd studied McLuhan and Finning's Wake, but people walked into this scene in the mid-90s with 19th century views of communication. And then it led to all kinds of disappointment. But then when they got Web 2.0 and they could make their own scene in some way, it's a replay of, okay, the print era, the Gutenberg era, dehumanized humans. But the electric age, beginning with radio, started to retrieve human communication, chemical body communication. Then that got wiped out by the Android meme, but the Android meme replays that. It begins in Web 1.0 with the Gutenberg effect that McLuhan called Leviathan, disappointing people. It's a tragedy which originally led into World War I. And then in Web 2.0, people like in the 60s and 70s had a renaissance. And this is all going on in the Android meme. They mimed the renaissance with Web 2.0.
Mm.
Where they felt, oh, this is neat. I don't have to be putting up with anybody. I got my own broadcasting going on. And they could police the interaction as much as they wanted to. See, I remember Carolyn when she went on Physicians Online in 94, 95, when we were in New York. And she was quite surprised at the ignorance of the doctors on this forum called Physicians Online. She thought doctors would have a bit of sensibility, but actually everybody was naive. And they didn't know that they'd have these nervous tics or bad shadows of themselves immediately emerge once they started reading competing points of view. They didn't know that they were latent monsters. So she quickly left that scene. It was purposeless, you know, so no exchanging of information. Other than what you think you are learning from your surveillance of Web 1.0.
Well, I remember that sense early, in like 96, 97. Participation, I felt anonymous. I felt like nobody would know me. And there was a freedom that you could make up things. You could say things without worrying about retribution or anything. You could, create your own role, your own image.
So you did that?
I just remember feeling the freedom of the sensation of being a stranger among strangers. And I felt freer to say what I wanted, type what I wanted onto the forum. It was the Shirley MacLaine forum.
Oh, yeah?
That was also in the times where I think a lot of people were thinking New Agey crap, but they would never admit it or talk about it out loud face-to-face to people. So you could...
And so it was done. It did get expressed on Shirley MacLaine's place.
Yeah, you could be anonymous and explore all the floofy New Age stuff. Without,
right. So you were quite happy with 1.0 then?
It was a phenomenal information bank, data bank of information. I remember thinking. I didn't really notice. Well, I can compare it to now, where now you feel like everybody has access to your data and you're more exposed on the internet.
Than before.
Than in your human body, your chemical body. More people. You're exposing yourself to the world on the internet now, as compared to my sense of feeling like nobody knew me when I was on
the internet. So that's what was different about Web 2.0.
Yeah.
You actually got more exposed. You know, I'm emphasizing the expressiveness of Web 2.0. You can express yourself many ways, and you can receive multitudes of expression. But you're talking about protecting your private identity, and 1.0 was easier than 2.0.
Yeah, a feeling of being less exposed or not exposing yourself, expressing without exposing yourself, and that is flipped, definitely flipped.
Anybody else got anything to say?
I would agree with Gene, but you were still being exposed. We just weren't aware of it.
Yes.
In 1.0.
Yes.
Because remember the time when Napster came out and people could share music? I was up into that when it first came out, and then they were shut down. So there was exposure that came into the back end, the control, that you thought you were anonymous, but not really.
Right. Yeah, probably even more exposed because nobody was working on all the tactics to confuse your identity or the source
right.
of your identity or your location.
Yeah. But now it's so full expression. I mean, from Facebook, YouTube, that you even heard the guy in the clip that Bob just played. He was amazed about YouTube. So it's really changed from like what Bob laid out, 1.0 to 2.0. I mean, was it a 9-year-old kid that could play, taught itself how to play music.
Yes, yes. And everybody investigates everybody now. Now it's not just the intelligence communities.
Yeah. And that's why that line in cliche archetype, our espionage is our daily activity. That's a major McLuhan statement.
Yeah.
And they're worried about the Facebook or the Pentagon or the CIA is monitoring people. What could they do about it? And maybe their monitoring is useful because they can monitor terrorists, or if they're not funding the terrorists. But
right.
You're not doing it. There's lots of opportunities for anything to happen. It seems it would require incredible surveillance. For people, for a little man to think that they need protection.
Yeah, even Mr. Damus wrote about everything that is going to happen, the major events. But
what was his quote? You say there was a quote?
No, he wrote about things that are going to happen.
Yeah.
So, in a way, if you do a retracing, you are doing this type of surveillance, but at another level of why are these things happening? Well,
okay, so you're saying that Nostradamus, he retraced, but he predicted that we'd be retracing?
Yes. He knew you were going to retrace, so he retraced on the opposite way.
Yes. He laid out the
into
the future.
The future.
Right. He
so
projected.
You're doing
the flip.
I'm going back to the traditional direction.
Yes.
Looking
because
back.
Why will he do these prophecies? What's the point?
Right. Well, he thought that we were coming to a difficult point. I mean, that's how it's presented in the documentary. There's a huge tragedy coming to humans. So the Christian would say, well, that's all part of the hard times before the second coming. Or those
it's
that aren't
Christian. Like, according to the Templars, little man, instead of going to the light, was getting more into caves.
Yeah, more in the dark.
The caves.
Mm-hmm. Caves of illusions, virtual realities of each media. So,
well, okay, that's where McLuhan
ending. They're descending.
Yeah, McLuhan said we may not be descending. He initially created the effect that there was an optimistic note. That's what people, when they read early McLuhan's Understanding Media, they thought, oh, there's some services, good things are going to come out of this new monstrous technology. So they stopped projecting the Orwellian vision. Maybe not the Aldous Huxley vision. That might have stuck there, but that might not have been a problem. So that's where McLuhan was different.
That's why I don't like the way Nostradamus is usually portrayed, because if Leonardo is already presenting the stairs of ascension to the light and the chromosome 14, they knew about this time, these things being known, and they knew there was going to be a solution. So
right.
They could not be that dramatic.
And so that's, McLuhan says in the article, the artist finds the redemption. Can you guys find that sentence? The stage of apprehension.
The way they wrote, like Rabelais or Nostradamus, is like Joyce. It's really poetic. It's really, like you say,
it's based on comedy.
Original creativity.
Yeah, it's based on the comic vision, not the tragic vision. But where's the sentence where he talks about the artist presents redemption, which is interesting in light of what we're saying. Definitely McLuhan presented a redemption, a potential redemption on a big level, big landscape level. So are you guys looking through the article? Well, couldn't you just do a search? Yeah, where is it? You just put the word in and won't it come up? Or is it a PDF and doesn't do it?
It's actually a link on a website.
So put in the word redemption and see. Tell me where it shows up.
Let me see. No, it won't do it. There's a search function on the site, but it won't pull it up. It took me to another site.
Okay,
let me download it into Word. Let me download into Word real quick.
And because this idea of redemption, it seemed odd in the article, but now it has a context. After discussing the bad projections of the Nostradamus documentary. Which bothered Roxy. Roxy, being an optimistic Mary Poppins kind of person, doesn't like the bad news.
No, I think it's really poetic. Like, I'm looking into quotes by Nostradamus. He says, from the calm morning, the end will come.
Yes.
When of the dancing horse, the number of circles will be nine.
Nine, N-I-N-E?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, he can be very poetic, like.
Yeah.
Bob, there's a statement in the article. It says, there is a passage in Stephen Hero which will serve to suggest the kind of debt Joyce owed to Flaubert and his successors. And
okay,
that is just before the paragraph that speaks about redemption.
Okay, what?
It examines the entire community in action and reconstructs the spectacle of redemption. Is that the one you were talking about?
Yeah. And what are the words that begin that paragraph?
The modern spirit is vivisective.
Oh, yeah, I read that. Isn't that near the beginning?
No, it's kind of in the middle. A little bit lower middle. The statement, it examines the entire community in action, is bolded.
Mm.
The modern spirit of vivisective is the first sentence, Bob.
Yeah, and I read that. So where is that?
And look for, it's just below Stephen Hero in italics. Stephen Hero is in italics. Look for that.
So you know that it's not in the beginning. I mean, I saw that sentence.
Yeah.
Can't find it now. The modern spirit is vivisective.
Are you using Firefox? Because do an edit fine.
No, I'm looking at the paper.
It's paper.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
But I'm just looking at, I remember I said the modern spirit is vivisective. So where did I start when I said that?
Well, the paragraph above begins with the word Dubliners.
Yeah.
Okay, look for that.
You stated it when you were doing your overview, Bob, when you started tonight. You started the vivisective.
So he says, Dubliners, for example, is a tapestry of such arrested apparitions.
Yep.
Yeah.
Don't go two paragraphs down.
Yeah.
Two paragraphs. Well, Dubliners goes on for quite a while till he gets to enjoy the achievement of Joyce and Eliot. Then it's no, that's a quote. That's a quote from Stephen Hero. Yeah, the modern spirit is vivisective. Okay, so Joyce says this. It examines the entire community. So the modern method examines its territory by the light of day. That's optimistic. We're safe. It examines the entire community in action and reconstructs a spectacle of redemption. Boy, so was there a redemptive position at every technological phase? Yeah, if you knew what was going on, you knew what was extended and going to cause an exaggeration, then you would know what would balance it. Or maybe even apply it personally. So the spectacle of redemption. That sounds like a conspiracy if you talk about the Android meme. They're going to, it's going to present a spectacle of redemption. That'll be us. So I just want you to know that when we're presented as solving the problems, we know the Android meme is setting us up somehow. Okay? I'll say... Charlie Rose said, Bob, how's it feel to win the Nobel Prize for Peace? Well, Charlie, I'm not fooled by the spectacle of redemption. What's that, Bob? You haven't read Stephen Hero? No, what's that? And just see constantly, I'll be saying every sentence, he'll go, what's that? What's that? What's that? And then he'll go, cut. And he said, I can't fucking broadcast this. You know, we can't have me saying, what's that? All like, okay, Bob, let me read your stuff. This is what he's going to say. Let me read your stuff, Bob, and I'll get back to you. And we'll interview you when I know that. And he'll never read the stuff, and we'll never have the interview. So there's what's waiting for us.
And the spectacle of redemption will never be defined clearly.
Right. I'll end up back here explaining to the three people listening about the failure of Charlie Rose.
Yep, the message has begun. Is now the message.
But by then,
we're about to fall asleep and Bob resurrects us all over again.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that the negativity in the Lost Book documentary that there is a redemption that Roxy's looking at it from, with the RNA drops and the REMAG and my ability to explain and make sense of everything. This is a great redemptive situation. Are you still with us, Brian? Are you able to handle this redemption?
Yep.
Yep. He can do it.
Yep.
Did Terrence McKenna get this far? He just talked about the hard wiring of the soul was like his most avant-garde statement or worry.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess he thought we were going to get really that. He had a sort of a little bit of an Android meme-ish, not really.
Yeah.
In the ever more user-friendly communicative technology was his rapturous vision, right? That eventually we would just live inside it. We'd live inside our articulations.
And he thought that psychedelics or whatever these compounds were would be a redemption, would get you out of that tendency. Did he? Did he think that?
I guess not as a push-button thing, like you would still have to rise to meet it. I mean, if I recall, his ultimate excuse for psychedelics was like, well, we don't have a lot of time, and these things can really jumpstart someone in a new direction.
Right.
Like you can defrag someone quickly. It's like electroshock.
But he's thinking that there's a problem coming, and if we're not defragged, we're going to get in trouble.
Right.
So he saw the psychedelics as a solution.
Yeah, or as a revelation of that would as the psychedelics as the thing that'll enable us to see, like, oh, what I've been doing is horrible, and I'm going to stop.
Yeah.
Or at least unconscious.
You pointed out that he, in a way, he kind of anticipated a little bit Iondom or Dobstown, because you point out, hey, he lives in Hawaii, or he lived in Hawaii, and he wrote about Hawaii, this special place. He had little interesting thought patterns.
Or
that
about,
could fit into things.
About, like, the solution of that, or that he liked living just in the beginning of being able to live in paradise while being connected to the world via the internet. You can still participate while being detached, a kind of a sort of an ultimate literate vision.
Yes. Yeah. So this, that, you know, Ion is, well, I from the deepest level says, well, nobody's going to die because you can't die. Then you get into the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions, and some of you guys are going to act out being dead, and it's going to be painful. And then he says, but it doesn't have to happen to you. So the all-encompassing themes of the last Book of Nostradamus, they had the literate view that, which McCoon called a projection of the mechanical vision, that everybody was inside the visual space container, and so everybody gets affected. They hadn't, electricity brings in the bit of a decentralized multi-consciousness, so not everybody's in the same prison subject to printing press effect. So the naive people like Jay Wiedner on this documentary, they're talking about disaster coming to people because of blanket visual space. And that, Nostradamus was projecting a blanket visual space that was going to do you in. That's where the breakthrough, the loopholes come in with electric decentralization. That might have been what Lewis and Joyce saw, and then McLuhan just made it simple, straightforward.
Okay.
That's why those documentaries are cliche and trashy. They're operating from a naive projection.
Yeah.
Like, there can be a solution, but not for everybody.
Right.
Well, it's like you're either going to bash me for this analogy, Bob, or otherwise laugh. But about a decade ago, I read that the oceans were perishing and that there would be no more seafood to eat in 40 years. And so I started buying, you know, shrimp and clams, and I started eating all the seafood because I was thinking, God, it's going to be gone.
Jesus.
And I didn't think that I had still had probably 30 years to eat it.
Wow.
I just.
That's pretty stupid.
What
the hell, friend? What had books? What had books done to your mind to make you think?
Paranoia.
Well, she bit that
holy shit, the Mars bars is going to be wiped out. I got to eat all these Mars bars.
Yeah, I just imagined
before.
It was going to get worse and worse, so I had to eat as much shrimp as I could.
Now, well, you imagine there was some kind of valuable nutrition in seafood?
Oh, no, it was taste at that time. It was like I loved
shrimp. Oh, you were addicted to good taste. You were
found
a good taste.
Yeah, so I had to eat it before it was gone.
you drowned yourself with as much of the taste.
Before it was gone or so bad. Yeah, because I imagined, you know, that it was just going to get so bad it wouldn't be edible anymore.
But see, there's where you're listening to a statement made in English, and you think you're inside all the realm of English. Therefore, you're subject to that disaster. See, there's a weird naivety there that you have no way of escaping. That you think you're going to go down with the other 7 billion people. See, you should look at where that image comes from, that conditioning.
We're all in this together?
Yeah, under literate conditions before World War I. You know, everybody can read and everybody gets the message and they all know what it means and it's bad and I'm going to have to prepare for it. There's a lot of naivety there, but natural naivety.
Right. I mean, and you were talking before about surveillance and sort of a knee-jerk Orwellian downspin or a possible services instead. And that's when I was listening live, anyway, talking about another quote that there was a lot of talk about, came back to this sentence from Joyce. That the philosophic college should spare a detective for me.
Yeah.
And he was saying, like, the vagaries of my mental wanderings or something.
Yeah.
Express the aesthetic instinct in action. That the philosophic, I was thinking, the philosophic college should spare a detective for me is a sort of an interesting...
couple meanings there. They should watch him.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking that in relation to, it's like, in the future, people will be lucky enough to have someone from the, quote, philosophic college, you know, go over everything they say and write and do with a fine-tooth comb, right? Or not even a person necessarily from the college, but an algorithm from the philosophic college, from the Illuminati lurkers, from the angels will be watching over your shoulder and looking for patterns in the vagaries of your whims. So it's kind of...
So there's a surveillance aspect there, a negative surveillance. The CIA shows up on your doorstep.
There's a negative surveillance, but it also creates the architecture that would make possible a situation where, you know...
You're helped.
Yeah, or where you're understood.
Well, this reminds me of, this is a great TV show, Manhunt, Unabomber. Boy, is it good.
Oh, yes.
So the last episode, they did all of MKUltra. They showed, they went into the whole thing was on him. They didn't have the other characters in there. So he showed his evolution as a person. And he goes to Harvard, and he's picked by this professor who's historically MKUltra. And the MKUltra guy betrays him. Compliments him, encourages him, likes what he's thinking. And then the first time they put the electrodes on his head, he brings in a bunch of other psychologists, and they start mocking this kid and showing how stupid he is and it reduces him to tears. He's only 16 or 17 and caused a real psychic wound that Ted Kaczynski then had to fight back. And so he continued in the program to set up, Henry Morgan was the name. But Morgan was telling them, well, you're a part of a very important experience. We're going to experiment. We're going to make this huge breakthrough in psychology, new knowledge in psychology, which is just analyzing the chemical brain skull with a couple of ideas. You know, nothing. He's doing this in the 50s. There's no clue of the global theater that's sneaking up on everybody. And now he introduces two men to the young Kaczynski, and they're CIA government. He says these are two men from the government, and they're these mean, beefy guys, never cracked a smile in 20 years, and they're looking at this kid, and he's supposed to, you know, like them, or, oh, that's good that those two fucking powerful assholes, thugs are watching, are interested in what I'm going to learn here. You know, and they look so mean. It's a 50s atmosphere when people could be mean like that. There was just men running the show, and they were mean. And it's very intimidating for the young Kaczynski. But the naivety of the psychologist to think that they could learn something from fucking with the kid and then project that over the society as new knowledge.
Right.
You know, MKUltra collapsed. They couldn't, they didn't know how to use it, and the insights were too puny.
Yeah, the assumption that you can collide particles in one person's head to learn about how they'll collide in everybody's head, that's a problematic assumption.
That's right. Like, here's Roxy making all these videos proving Bob's the last king. Now, okay, back in the 50s, I could hold a press conference, and everybody would listen to me. Oh, a guy showed up, he found it. This is like the Benjamin Cream fantasy that Jesus is waiting in East London in the Pakistani community ready to give his press conference. You know, some people still think that's what's going to happen. They think the president's going to make a press conference and solve everything by his nice words. Huge naivety there. So, yeah, I'm going to make a press conference and say, well, you know, I control the moon. Recent studies have shown I control the moon. And every one of you guys are fucking under my control. So listen to what I have to say. You must listen to Frank Zappa and maybe a little beeper on the side, as Ian called it, and you lay out some stupid program. Oh, man, is that stupid. You know, we even suspect that one could do that. And probably the Church of Subgenius was an outlet for baby boomer minds or younger minds to realize that point. What the? There's nothing. Nobody's listening, so let's just start making up shit or, you know, making jokes and swearing. That's the best my press conference is going to be. The subject stream is you get to have your press conference, and then you insult the whole world with some incredible rant.
That's Bob's MK Ultra. You're MK Ultra-ing us all the time.
Yes, dang.
In that MK movie,
Ultra,
Bob.
EM Culture. EM Culture. Hey, you got the word culture in there. Cultura.
Yeah.
Culture.
EM Cultured.
Yeah. What were you
in that movie, Kaczynski's narrating his own, you know, biography of his history.
Yeah.
And he says in the end, because for 2 years they put him through that, bashing and demeaning and bullying, and he said, "I never let them break me. I never let them." So it just hardened him and made him.
But see, it did break him. That's what people would, I've mentioned to people, and they said, well, he was ruined by MKUltra. He didn't think he got ruined. He thought he beat them. But it did something to him maybe he wasn't aware of. But he was maybe right there in that episode, he was starting to become aware of it because he was saying, I'm not going to be mad at the world anymore. He was saying something like that. Once he got published, see, he had an epiphany. Once he got to express himself, and everybody heard his press conference, which was his manifesto published in the New York Times, he relaxed, and he allowed himself to see that he didn't need to be pissed off anymore. So that's the first sentence of McLuhan in his first essay in Explorations. The natural desire for all media to express themselves, and that includes people, and to have the world think like you. That's the biggest neurotic hang-up of humans coming out of,
the
literate phase.
To feel heard, right?
Yeah, as if your thinking is important.
Wow.
If you listen to my first broadcast, October 1st, 1984, with Nelson and James Kidney, there's a guy who doesn't respect his own thoughts, who immediately recognizes the absurdity of attempting to tell anybody anything. You will notice that, the way I present myself.
Oh, man.
It's a great press conference. Eventually, I turn on Nelson and Jay. I turn on my colleagues and accuse them of trying to kill me. It's actually quite a funny press conference if you look at it that way.
God, I got to listen again.
Yeah, and then Nelson, Bob, can we get back on the same page? He's trying to calm me down. Bob, let's get back to our report to the people. Stop fucking being silly. It is quite hilarious if you look at it that way. Great press conference. Okay, so it's interesting that, okay, the labyrinth of cognition is what the psychologists were trying to figure out. Mark Stallman and I talked to the Evergreens, and we talked to the cybernetics guy, Norbert Wiener. And what was he up to? And he said, well, everybody back then was trying to figure out how to make a genius in the late 40s, how to make the kids smarter, prepare them for the Cold War or something. And that's what McLuhan is doing here. He's saying that I've discovered the stages of apprehension and what makes them and what's happened to the things that make your stages of apprehension. He was trying to analyze the learning process, but a very, as he would say, very esoteric sources in his studies, whereas the psychologists or the MIT cybernetics guys were looking into whatever scientific laboratory stuff they had, trying to figure out how to program the young people. And that's the last arrogance. That's the last role of the parent, is to supposedly be of benefit to the kid. They don't define it that way, but in the end, there's supposed to be some service. And McLuhan's starting to notice, I don't think we can be of any service to anybody. Let's just let the kids run around the university and bullshit all day long. Let them fucking work it out. But
yeah,
he was
saying, it's warming.
Go ahead.
You know, form over the problems.
Yeah.
People talk about that now as a good strategy, and that was sort of his educational blueprint. Just go out into the city and swarm that problem and interrogate.
Right, and you're saying people might say that's useful now. They can see that.
Yeah, yeah.
Flash mobs. Flash mob is an attempt to learn something from the city, to poke it, to see if it's alive. Yeah. So, but he's sitting there saying, well, you can go out and flash mob all over the place. Eventually, you're going to realize it doesn't get anywhere. And then you're going to come back to him, and I'll lay out the ABCs of what you can now understand. You know, he just sort of waited on the sidelines till everybody exhausted themselves, and then they would be ready to understand what he was saying.
And McLuhan's approach was way more effective than MK Ultra ever.
Oh, I figured out.
Yes, because McLuhan is MMK Ultra.
Oh, yeah. He's got MC. Ooh, McLuhan, he's an acronym. What do you call that when you change the letters? You do that, Brian.
An acronym.
Yeah, no, what is it when you change the letters?
Anagram.
Anagram?
Anagram. Holy shit, yeah. McLuhan has MK Ultra right in his fucking name.
MK.
Who discovered that? Who came up with that idea? You Rocky did, eh?
That's a new thought, Bob. I don't think anybody's really said that. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, that is new.
I've been saying for years. Yeah, that sitting its wake is the key to MK Ultra. But I forgot to say that McLuhan. Well, I said he translated. But I forgot to say, McLuhan figured out MK Ultra, and it was in his name. But that's what Ted Carpenter told me. He and McLuhan in 51, 52 were looking at what anthropology was doing, and they went to a conference of anthropologists and maybe psychologists, and they were shocked at the sort of the big brother mentality of some of these anthropologists, and they retreated from it. And Ted told me it was at that point when the CIA started going around and signing up the anthropologists that would go along with whatever their negative scenario was and those that wouldn't. And the one who wouldn't was Dorothy Lee, who Carpenter always praises as the greatest member of the McLuhan seminar, the McLuhan think tank, and gave key ideas to McLuhan. But she wouldn't do it, so she got made anonymous. She became an unknown person, other than Ted Carpenter. But that's where I come in and attack Ray Birdwhistle, which some of you more savvy posters know the name. Have you done that, Brian? Have you mentioned Ray Birdwhistle?
It's funny because I haven't looked him up, but I know the scene in your diary where
you... Yeah, I confront the fucker.
The action scene.
And he was one of the guys. I talked to Ted about him later.
Remind us, Bob.
Well, he was one of the bad guys. He even writes an article for Explorations in there, but he's one of the psychologists. He goes with the CIA, and he becomes a big deal. You know, he becomes an authority in pink anthropology, which overlaps into studying marketing. It becomes what advertising's doing, focus group studies. See, advertising was the big brother, and McLuhan said the ratings, the Nielsen ratings, were the essence of Big Brother. Nobody was looking at the Nielsen ratings as Big Brother, I don't think, back then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
And so when he says, what?
Go ahead. It's a, no,
yeah. When he says the modern psychologist, historiographer, and archaeologist, as well as the physicist, the chemist, and the private eye, all use this stages of apprehension process, that's what the CIA was doing. They were taking psychologists, historians, archaeologists, all of knowledge, and putting together in their interdisciplinary think tank and coming up with a formula to condition people with.
Mm.
And then that led into
the survey. And using the survey to analyze their success or their...
Using the ad agencies. You know,
yeah,
J.W. Right. Thompson. I think that's the famous ad agency that made Nixon president in 1968. And I think Haldeman was a member of that company. They were the top ad company at that point. So now McLuhan is on to this 20 years before. And you have to look, the secret conspiracy-oriented part of McLuhan, he means this MKUltra part in here.
Right.
He doesn't say it right away. But he's showing how knowledge is coming together and certain brain trusts are working on managing the global theater, programming the environment, programming the planet. Which is interesting. That's where you get LaRouche. LaRouche is more blatant about saying that than McLuhan. And McLuhan and LaRouche goes back and analyzes all the anthropologists and people came out of the Tavistock Institute in London. And McLuhan is doing it with him and Ted Carpenter are doing it in the North American context.
Mm-hmm.
So the...
Yeah.
The
then,
you then, know, when he talks about implosion... And Big Brother goes inside. Big Brother goes inside because the world implodes and the word makes the market. So whoever is at the center team of elites is programming the planet. He was describing a political situation that people did not understand. Therefore, they thought McLuhan was apolitical. They didn't know he was describing what the SDS was going to have to deal with. What Mae Brussels started to notice later.
Yeah, and I mean, in multiple, like, as a great poet, in multiple ways. I mean, the SDS or the modern freedom-loving activists have to deal with the fact that the surveillance system